Welcome. It is now time for SDFO to VOIP. Please dial 929-299-1269 to join the conversation.
Welcome to the SDF conferencing system. You are the only party in this conference.
VOIP 229-299-1269.
Hello on radio listeners. Coming up next hour is a free open time slot. Are you creative and reliable? Then why not become a DJ and support on radio? Come on, it's not that you have anything better to do, I know, right?
VOIP 929 299 1269.
One other party is in this conference. There are two other parties in this conference. There are three other parties in this conference.
Hello, hello, this is Publius calling in.
Hello, Publius.
How are you?
How are you? That's a great response. How are you? I noticed you dialed on the Twitch stream, and then I dialed, but I was here before you.
Well, that's really interesting because the delay, round-trip delay is so bad that I'm just now seeing myself dial on the Twitch stream.
But here's the thing is, I dialed the secret backdoor number, which is from your STF VoIP phone or your phone that has SIP access or whatever. Dial 1086. And it just dropped you right in the conference.
Without all of the preliminaries.
Without the multi-freak and, you know, the tandem switching and I think that's T carrier or maybe N carrier that you hear the kind of, you know, the frequency in the background kind of ringing. It's from a recording, of course. It's not actually being generated. But that's the secret, 1086 instead of...
I'm sure that you have an ambition to set up this whole system so that, you know, you actually have T-carrier loops, you know, half a meter long or something.
Oh, right, yes. I've seen the shortest T1 in the world that was, I think it was 6 inches of, you know, that red T1 wire that you use typically. Yeah. It was about 6 inches.
I have to admit to you that I have this plan because I found out that there's some of the Cisco routers which have a voice over IP function, and you can get these T1 cards to go in them. Oh. And I figured out that the stuff is fairly cheap on the secondary market. It would be possible to put together one of these things with like 24 or 32 T1 ports. You know, and then get a bunch of channel banks and then have just all the phone lines. There's no possible reason anyone would ever want this number of phone lines in their home, but...
Yeah, in kind of a lab setting. Mm-hmm. Or you could call up your local telephone provider, which I think is Southwestern Bell.
Hello, this is Jazzmaz.
Hello, Jazzmaz.
I can think of one use if you're running a bookie joint out of your house where you may need
to... Okay, market shop!
Yes. How about sex lines?
Yeah.
Make it interesting. Just kidding. How about Venusian sex lines? There you go.
Venusian sex lines. Hmm.
This woman, why is she making out with me? She thinks that she is your mate. Oh, my God.
the professor is just absolutely appalled by this.
Right. I am a widower. I have three children. Three grown children. She should be ashamed of herself.
My mother, of course, this book was among her father's things. She was remarking that she thought she had read the book, but she thinks she may have gotten to a certain point and given it up in disgust. They say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, so the author of this book must have been a very dangerous man. The moon of Venus and the whole business of the blazing meteor and, you know, comets with no fixed orbit, the yellow snow.
Yellow snow, yes. Don't eat the yellow snow. Man, what's gasto? Gasto just sounds so good and generic. Is it like Soylent Green?
Gasto.
Gasto is their food, right?
Yes, the distilled essence of flowers.
Oh, the distilled essence of flowers. Where the Venusians can, what are they? Are they butterflies?
It's not clear. They seem rather curious in their habits, to be sure. But, you know, this is supposedly they look like humans and they don't have long proboscises that stick out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they live on the perfume of flowers, which seems like a rather insubstantial thing to get your energy and other nutrients from, if you ask me, which, you know.
Well, who knows? I mean, Venus is a... life on Venus must be very... I don't know. It must be very... there's a lot of pressure living on Venus. I'm just trying to think of, and how on earth that they can look up into the sky and see that crescent half moon. I didn't say it was a crescent moon, I said it was a half moon. Yeah, I just don't know how you can get your bearings looking for, if you even know you're looking up with all the pressure on your head. Beating you down, compacting you down into the surface. But then what's the atmosphere made up of? Is it methane or sulfuric acid or something?
So what we know of the atmosphere of Venus is that it's mostly carbon dioxide.
Oh.
And there's immense, really immense quantity of carbon dioxide. I mean, I think you'd have to convert all the coal and all the carbonates on Earth into carbon dioxide to have that kind of pressure. Truly immense amount of carbon dioxide, and the atmospheric pressure at the surface is, you know, there's some nitrogen in there, probably about as much nitrogen as we have, except that it's just a trace when compared to the immense amount of carbon dioxide, because apparently what has happened is that the water that existed, which was probably about the same amount of water as on Earth, evaporated and was broken down by ultraviolet light, and the hydrogen escaped, and the oxygen stayed behind and oxidized whatever carbon compounds were there, thus producing carbon dioxide. And, of course, there's other stuff. For example, there's layers. There's a certain altitude at which radar reflection shows these very, very bright reflections, which leads us to conclude that there's metallic iron surface, which is produced by the decomposition of ferric chloride. So there's ferric chloride in the lower atmosphere, and it rises up, and at a certain altitude it decomposes and leaves the iron behind, and then I guess the chlorine is liberated and, you know, goes somewhere else again.
Wow.
And then at the clouds are made up greatly of droplets of hydrogen sulfate, sulfuric acid, as you might say, sulfuric acid anhydride. It's really a nasty situation all around. The most interesting thing that's been suggested And I don't know that we actually have good enough data in the form of photographs from the surface to be 100% clear on this. But the interesting thing to me is the thought that the refractive index is so high that light bends around the horizon all the way around the planet.
Okay. So it's just, some kind of ducting.
Yeah. So yeah, tropospheric ducting for visible light. How do you like the thought of that?
That's what I was thinking.
You get out your Aldus lamp and signal people on the other side of the planet.
Like, hey.
Like.
Well, but the thing is what's interesting is why. Well, of course, for us as a reference, the Earth is a pretty nice place to live. But you know, I hear people when describing, yes, Venus used to have oceans just like the Earth, or Mars used to have oceans just like the Earth. And then it's like, I don't know. I mean, is it just born there, or are they just talking for a very brief history of time as those planets were continuing to transition, just as ours is doing itself? Because we know that we once had lots of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and probably not very hospitably humans.
Yeah, the Earth, of course, starts out with a reducing atmosphere, and then the efforts, then about 2 billion years ago, the photosynthetic organisms first develop, and they start producing oxygen as a waste product, and they, because the atmosphere of Earth originally was probably fairly similar to the atmosphere of Titan, only warmer. So, Titan doesn't have carbon dioxide or water in its atmosphere because it's too cold. Those things freeze out. But the original atmosphere of the Earth probably would have been consisting of nitrogen and carbon dioxide and hydrocarbon gases. So like methane, ethane, propane and butane, which are, they're more or less gases at room temperature. They're condensable gases, butane particularly. And then you would have had a certain amount of ammonia just formed, if nothing else, by the interaction of ultraviolet light and lightning strikes and the hydrocarbon compounds and water vapor. And the thing is that over time this forms complex organic compounds, and there probably also were some complex organic compounds already in existence because we have, we have the evidence of the carbonaceous chondrite asteroids, which have some fairly complex organic compounds. In fact, the comparison has been made most notably by Marshall Savage in a fascinating book entitled The Millennial Project, which, if you can find a copy of it, is well worth having for the references alone. It's kind of crackpotish, but it's also got beautiful illustrations, and there's lots of references. Anyway,
so
he points out...
go ahead.
He points out that the carbonaceous fraction of the carbonaceous chondrite asteroids, which we should be clear, in a typical carbonaceous chondrite meteorite, it's mostly silicaceous rock bound together with this sort of asphalt-like substance. But he compares it usefully to kerogen, which is the organic fraction in the oil shale. But it's got quite a bit of complex hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, sulfur compounds. And so that would have been present, presumably, in the primordial Earth. And so life at that time was basically living off of, if we want to say it this way, fossil fuels, and then switch with the advent of photosynthesis to a renewable resource.
Okay. Right. Well, if you want to get your grant so you can do your research, yes, that's how you frame it.
It is now time for SDFO2VOIP.
You could really
please
think of the way solar systems is formed as sort of the gods rolling dice, and then... and maybe kind of like a roulette wheel as well, with the Goldilocks band, so to speak. I guess the other thing too is it's just so ingrained in our thinking that all of the planets in our solar system are static in a way,
which
we think the Earth is static as well, right? We just happen to be in this portion of time for the Earth to exist as it does. Who knows that, I think we can predict that our sun is going to become bloated at some point and probably envelop the Earth. The Great Recycling, that's how you apply for that grant, for that research. The great Recycler, the end game, at least for humans, unless we get off this rock, start filling up. One idea that you could do, we probably should start doing now, get built container, or no, just get shipping containers and fill them up with random stuff and then just start sending them out, you know, into different trajectories, preferably ones that don't, you know, can leave the solar system.
So that's a kind of panspermia hypothesis.
Right. At least, and I told somebody about this, and they were like, why would you do that? Why would you want to do that? And I was just like, well, maybe at some point in the future, some intelligent life will come across this Maersk, or who, no, that's a...
valuable merchandise.
Costco.
Containers,
not,
sure.
Not Costco, but is it Costco or Costco?
Costco, yeah. Costco,
yeah.
And Maersk, and yeah.
Oh, okay, so I was right, yeah. And PIS. Yes. So anyways, yeah, they come across this, you know, rectangular container floating through the, traveling through space. They get to it, they'd open it up, and they would just be full of all this, basically inert objects that are relics of civilization on a planet that is long gone because its sun decided to eat it. But it's another thing to think about that, because when the sun does go red giant, or when it bloats, it's how is that going to affect the system of Jupiter? I mean, do you have a potential for some time, enough time to pass, that something could happen in Jupiter?
I mean, now that's an interesting question. I mean, the Jupiter is much further out than the Earth, of course. So even if the sun as a red giant will probably inflate to a diameter large enough that the Earth's current orbit would be in the outer photosphere, but Mars would probably be left where it is, and then Jupiter is far beyond that. Now, the luminosity of a red giant is considerably greater than that of a main sequence star, although its temperature is much lower because, anyway, the size is much larger.
But the thing I'm trying to get at is that I know that it's not as pleasant as the sun is now, if you can say the sun is pleasant. It's pretty dangerous. But when it gets to that point, will there be enough time for it to exist in some kind of a stable state that it could affect Jupiter and Europa in a way that, you know, that you have the potential for things to change so dramatically like they did on the Earth after the Earth was formed?
Yeah, I think the answer is we don't really know how long that process honestly takes. If the estimate is a billion years, that's really longer than we would expect the sun to remain in a red giant phase before withering away into a white dwarf. Whereas, you know, if it takes 100 million years, there might be enough time. And that's sort of the thing, is the red giant phase is relatively short, because that's where you're in the helium burning phase of the star's existence. You have two processes that go on. You have the transition from
burning hydrogen to burning helium.
Right. Well, the other thing that happens that can happen, you know, in larger stars, you get a different kind of fusion reaction than the one we get in our sun, because our sun has the proton-proton fusion reaction. In larger stars, you get a catalytic fusion reaction. This is the one discovered by Hans Bethe, in which carbon actually serves as a kind of nuclear catalyst. And the thing about that is the reaction rate is much higher, but the activation energy is also higher. So it only happens in larger mass stars.
Okay.
That's why larger mass stars, you know, a blue-white giant star has such a very short existence. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why, is that it's not just that the higher temperatures and pressures result in the faster rate of fusion in the core, it's that it's actually got a different process of fusion which goes much faster, but which our sun isn't massive enough to initiate.
Gotcha.
Now, Mungo comments, you know, Earth's oceans are pretty unique compared to other planets because of all the liquid water we have here. Well, that's the interesting part, is that there's a great deal of evidence that both Venus and Mars 3 or 4 yeah. billion years ago had exactly that.
Well, and the right. And I mean, I think we're pretty convinced too that Europa sort of is in that kind of the phase where yes, it has lots of liquid or lots of water, but it's not quite liquid.
The satellites of Jupiter yeah. have the possibility of having liquid water further, you know, beneath the surface because strong tidal heating. Except of course for Io, which is volcanic.
Oh yeah, that just likes to puke sulfur everywhere. Sulfur volcano emitting volcanoes. Actually, don't they? Doesn't it pepper Ganymede with a sulfur trail or something?
Well, you wind up with this belt of material that actually
actually kind of a neat thing. I mean, if you think about the way that solar systems are formed, I mean, it's all kind of like a group project here.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so in the case of Venus, for example, we have measurements of the abundance of deuterium on Venus. So there's traces of water vapor in the Venus atmosphere, which we've been able to detect thanks to actually, you know, going there with automated systems, and measure the abundance of deuterium as opposed to hydrogen. And you know, here on Earth, the abundance of deuterium to hydrogen is larger than it is in the sun because a certain proportion of the primordial hydrogen has evaporated away and left the Earth because, of course, if you get hydrogen gas, room temperature hydrogen gas has a molecular velocity comparable to the Earth's escape velocity, so it tends to escape into space and then be blown away by sunlight pressure. And so we've lost a considerable amount of water over the course of cosmic time, or hydrogen over the course of cosmic time, and that hydrogen, of course, because deuterium is heavier, it's retained better. And so we have a higher abundance of deuterium in earthly water than in the cosmos as a whole, or the sun as a whole, or in, say, Jupiter, presumably. Now, on Venus, the abundance of deuterium is much, much higher, which suggests that it's the remnant of, again, there's not very much water, but what there is seems to have been the primordial amount seems to have been about the same as for Earth, and it's been lost to a much greater extent, and so the deuterium fraction is much higher. Now, for Mars, I don't know that anybody really has good measurements on that. We look at Mars, you know, and we see see formations in the ground that look like water erosion. We see basins that look like they might have held oceans, and at the fringes of them we see sand dunes and formations of that nature, which lead us to believe that there were considerably more water on Mars at one time than there is now. And we have evidence of subsurface water, probably very saline, which occasionally erupts to the surface and causes erosion and similar features. Now, what's really interesting about this is that there's very good evidence here on Earth that there's, you know, we've got these vast oceans, right? Lots of water at the surface. I mean, you know, when you consider the surface to be the crust of the planet, you understand.
Yeah.
So vast oceans, great amounts of water. But there is plenty of evidence to suggest that in the mantle, it's 1,000 kilometers deep or what have you. In the mantle, there is probably 10 times as much water as there is in the surface in the crust and the oceans of the Earth. And so that water is gradually brought up to the surface through volcanic action and so on, and probably a great deal of that, you know, which we can think of as being like water of hydration in solid rocks, you know, because a great deal of that is probably still left inside Mars, because the thing about Mars is it cooled down more rapidly because of its small size, and so its tectonics became frozen effectively. And so probably a great deal of that deep lithospheric water, if you want to call it lithospheric water, is probably still there.
It is just that one of its Mars's hugest faults is that it captured Phobos like an idiot. So it's like, here's an asteroid. Hey, I want another moon. No, you can't have another moon. Okay, you're gonna have another moon. Okay, all right. Well, you just signed any possibility of life away, Mars.
But it's interesting because, you know, for example, the Tharsis Montes, you know, Olympus Mons and the others, are antipodal to an enormous depression, which suggests that what may have happened is that fairly late in Mars, we'll say geological evolution, areological, if you want to be weird about it, there was a big impact from, you know, at least Phobos. But the planet effect produced whatever remains produced by shield volcanoes. We have evidence. There is some evidence to suggest, and I'm not saying that this is perfectly well established, because there's some evidence that the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary impact here on Earth, right, was really amazingly bad luck for the dinosaurs, because firstly the impact occurred in a bed of carbonates, which dumped huge amounts of carbonate into the atmosphere suddenly, which resulted in massive climate change, and soot and, you know, darkening of the skies and so on. And the other thing that happens is it was antipodal to the Deccan Traps, which are these immense volcanic formations, and it looks as though those eruptions were already going on, but it may have stimulated them massively, pumping huge amounts of additional ash into the atmosphere, which again resulting in global cooling, basically, that we had this long epoch, I mean, long by human standards, you know, yeah. Geologically it would have cleared out in a few million years, but you're talking about a global epoch of dusty, you know, atmosphere and massive reduction in the amount of sunlight that reaches the surface.
Right.
And that's the sort of you takes a long time to recover from.
Yeah. Right. And those kinds of concepts and formations of solar systems and, you know, what happens when basically a solar system dies, those are such long durations of time that it's very hard for human beings to wrap their brains around that, because they constantly want to bring it into something that they might be able to understand, which is maybe 5 or 10 years. You know,
A lot of scientists and science popularizers have used all these really elaborate similes, like saying, okay, well, go to London or New York, go to Cleopatra's Needle, and look how tall it is. Now imagine the postage stamp balanced on the very tip of that obelisk. Yeah. And so if the obelisk represents geological time, the thickness of that postage stamp is all of human history, you know.
Right. Or the very last second of the very last day of the hour of the very, you know, very last minute of that of the year, the cosmic year. Mm-hmm. The whole point of it being is that, you know, it's never going to be, you know, 75 degrees all year round like San Diego. You're not going to have a planet that's San Diego. That's impossible, and you wouldn't want to have that, even though that is a very desirable climate for some human beings. It's just, if you don't have this kind of ebb and flow and a life cycle of a solar system, you're not going to have a possibility of any life. And you have to live in those, you have to live in the troughs, right? That's where kind of the magic happens. And thank God for whatever thing hit the planet. You know, I mean,
yeah, I mean, this sure. is bad for the dinosaurs, but ultimately good for us.
Right. And we're so lucky about Phobos impacting Mars, because look, now we have no Martians to battle with.
Well, it's interesting. There's a live hypothesis that because Mars cooled faster than the Earth, then, you know, that is entirely possible that primitive life arose on Mars and was actually transferred to the Earth by impacts.
We have evidence of that found in Antarctica, I thought.
Yeah, well, there is a certain amount of evidence. You see, the thing being that we know that impacts on Mars can knock chunks off of it, which escape Mars gravitation, and some of those chunks can then find their way to the Earth. Now, it's assumed that typically it takes hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years for that orbital process to occur, but there are studies which suggest that in rare cases, that could take less than 10 years. And it's entirely possible. You know, there are many microorganisms which have sporulated forms, which are very resistant to radiation and vacuum and dryness and all those other things. And so it's, and you know, and the spores of the Clostridium tetani bacterium, for example, for an unpleasant example.
Yeah.
But you know, so it's been posited, it's been hypothesized that chunks have been knocked off of primordial life-bearing Mars and came to primordial non-life-bearing Earth and actually seeded the Earth.
Congratulations, we're all evolved from primordial
yes.
tetanus, right?
We are the Martians. Wasn't there a story in Omniant about that?
The one I always think of is Genesis by H.B. Piper.
Okay.
But yes. And yeah. with its you know, last line about how, and we laugh at the fanciful story from Mars. So.
Yeah.
But it's actually a pretty good story. But it's not certainly not the only story that's been written on that theme either. But yeah, so the idea is, the thing is, the Planetary Society, and of course everything went wrong, but it was an interesting experiment. They made up this, it looked like nothing so much as a package of birth control pills. But it was a little experiment. It was a disc with foil disc with these little packets, each of them containing little bumps, each containing some microorganism.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to send it into space and bring it back. And so the first thing they were going to do, they were going to fly it on a shuttle flight and bring it back and see what happened. And that, if I recall correctly, wound up being the...
Not the Challenger.
No, the terrible last flight of Columbia.
So
and then they signed up. They were going to send the thing on a Mars sample return mission because somebody was going to send a spacecraft to Mars and bring something back. In this case, it was the Russian, I want to call it Phobos mission, that they were going to fly a spacecraft to Mars.
That name again.
Take a sample of Phobos, not try to land on Mars, but land on Phobos, take a sample of it, and bring that sample back to Earth. And, that never got out of Earth orbit. The upper stage engines misfired, and it landed in Chile somewhere.
Oh, man.
So that's the sort of the thing, that the project never really went anywhere, but it was a valiant effort. Now, in the process, the Planetary Society discovered that, thanks to the wonderful world of ITAR, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, they actually had to register as an international arms dealer in order to put an experiment aboard a Russian space probe. So if you hear any stories about, the Planetary Society running guns to obtain extra revenue, that's why. It's because the U.S. government forced them to register as an international arms dealer.
Wow. and I guess another thing too that is kind of interesting is that with our perspective and just kind of learning about our neighborhood in a way, that we're also have maybe convinced ourselves just through the way that things, time and space are taught, that this is just how it is, and that our solar system has stopped evolving and will not evolve over the next 5 billion years. I guess is 5 billion years. What is it? We have an average sun, and isn't it 10 billion years its life?
Like, yeah, I mean, we seem to be about currently about halfway through the existence of a typical main sequence, G0 star. We're about halfway through a 10 billion year period. And I don't know if you know how that's, so there's two different ways of calculating that. One of them is the Hertzsprung-Russell method is by observing stars and their abundance in the universe, basically.
Right.
And you can make some assumptions and figure out what their relative lifespans are. But the other thing, the other way that you wind up calculating the lifespan of a star is by looking at the amount of fuel that it has and how rapidly it consumes it. And the thing is, of course, that our sun consumes immense quantities
Hello
of
and welcome.
Matter.
It is now time for SDFO to VOIP. Please dial 929-1269 to join the conversation.
Less than 10% of the mass of the sun, the sun essentially does not undergo something like turbulent convective mixing. So the result is that only the hydrogen that's in the central section will be consumed and converted to helium. Now, if we had something like turbulent convective mixing, then you could look at the entire hydrogen supply
gotcha.
Of a star,
yeah. okay.
and its lifespan would be much longer. But as it is, you get to a point essentially where there's too much helium and not enough hydrogen in the core
right.
of the star, and the fusion reaction just stops working properly.
Which is part of why it starts to collapse on itself, and then it becomes another chain reaction.
Right,
and then floats it out.
Right. The thermodynamics are interesting, but yeah, the thing being, if you could, in principle, you know, and heaven knows how you would conceivably accomplish this, but in principle, if you could mix the star, the core material, lift some of the core material up and replace it with material from the outer layers, you could actually extend the lifespan of a star by a considerable degree, and that
that is beyond the scale of any human
endeavor.
Theoretical. There you go. Hey, you'll get that grant. I know you will.
Interesting thing. Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the idea of just sending, like, having, we talked about conveyor belts to space. A conveyor belt for just trash to just send it to the sun. I was like, that maybe humans could do that, like, you know, and not affect the inner planet so much or even have trash come back and fall on the Earth. That might be possible. And you know, people will say that, well, it's not worth it. It's just easier to bury it in the ground. And maybe it is. But there you go.
One of the things that's all that really
another purpose for the sun is what I'm saying.
One of the things that's very interesting to me is that back in the 1960s, sort of the, you know, there's sort of two schools of environmentalism, you might say, and one of them is the kind of back to nature, you know, school, and the other is the okay, let's see what we can do here to solve the problems we have school. I'm simplifying, but
yeah.
Glenn Seaborg, who of course is remembered as the man who had a chemical element named after him during his lifetime because he had a habit of just making up new chemical elements all the time. But Glenn Seaborg was a great environmentalist, but of course he was a high technology, what you might call hard path, in opposition to the soft path advocated by people like Amory Lovins, which so far hasn't worked very well. But you know, he was a hard path environmentalist, and one of the things he talked about a lot was recycling by means of the plasma torch, that if you have enough energy, you can take your garbage and you can vaporize it and then just separate out the constituent elements. Now, obviously, this is not the ideal thing to do for most circumstances because, as Doug Jones once put it to me, you want to keep that entropy. You know, in other words, there's complex chemical compounds, complex material forms, which you'd rather reuse in their existing state.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are some things like, say, computer circuit boards.
Mm-hmm.
Where you just, there is no feasible way of disentangling all the components in order to reuse them. And so what do you do?
Well,
thing to do would be to plasma torch it, and then you get the carbon and the hydrogen and the silicon and the copper and the gold and whatever all separated out, you know, like in a mass spectrometer, essentially.
Well, in a way, that's kind of what happens now. I don't know if you know this. You probably do. But there's, you know, containers of e-waste. Like, when you go to recycle your e-waste and you go to your reputable recycler, there's a whole slew of bottom feeders that this sieves that this falls down through. And eventually, whatever's left over that, you know, could be resold in the U.S. market or in Europe or Japan or wherever, it eventually ends up on the shores of Bangladesh or and other countries where poor souls toil away with blowtorches, you know, just try. And
attention on radio listeners. Coming up at 0300
like
hours UTC is
too.
A Penmic with open mic.
The people that are breaking down these circuit boards with blowtorches, hand torches, that's not even the bottom of the barrel as far as e-recycling is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really shady business. It's disgusting. But the idea of using plasma to then, you know, separate it, I should say, and then collect the elements that you need to that you want to reuse. It just seems so much more humane. I mean, I know it takes an immense amount of energy, but it also takes an immense amount of energy to fill up things in a container and, you know, go through a process and then ship it
to the other side of the world. Well, this is the thing, is that what good is using energy except to improve the lives of people? And so I think that it's a blot upon our civilization that we're treating this waste this way, that we've got little kids in Africa somewhere breathing toxic fumes because they're trying to separate out, you know, the valuable components from these vast heaps of trash they effectively live on. This is horrifying. This is something that we shouldn't be doing. You know, I mean, it makes me mad. I mean, I have a friend who's very mad about all the production side of manufacturing being done in China and places like that, because she says, you know, you look at it and it's like the United States in the late 60s with rivers catching fire and things like that, except over that we've super added the whole thing of having to transport everything, you know, with these oil burning ships that, you know, belch crap into our atmosphere, you know. But then you look at the other end of it and, you know, there's ships don't get scrapped in America anymore. They send them to Pakistan, and people are working with hand tools and breathing asbestos without respirators and things like this. This is shameful, and we should absolutely not be permitting this in our civilization. If we want to be civilized people, if we want to really be the people that we have the ability to be, what we need, I think, and again, this is my reason for being a big booster of nuclear energy, is to say, I think we need more energy. We need enough energy that everybody in the world can enjoy a U.S.-level standard of living, and that we can responsibly deal with the waste products of our civilization instead of shuffling them off to some poor country where people don't have any choice but to accept whatever crap rains on them from the first world. You know, it's like you can imagine this like the city in Battle Angel Alita, if you ever remember that, you know, where you've got the people who dwell up in the clouds and then they rain their garbage down on the people who live below them. And that's effectively the world that we live in, and I object to that. I think that's fundamentally immoral. And you know,
it's not
if we had no other choice,
there are documentaries and stories, but it's like it's out of sight, out of mind, and that's a bad thing. And again, it has to do with short-sightedness and the way that I don't mean the visually impaired folks. Sorry, if I offended anybody. Anyways, the idea that we have a very finite period of time that we're able to grasp. Like I said, 5 to 10 years, probably less for most people, or a few minutes. It's like these things that are happening on a daily basis that you're talking about, and you know, okay, well, this week I'm going to protest nukes because it's the anti-nuke thing that we do it every year. Hey, by the way, that was just this weekend, wasn't it? The anti-nuke thing.
Oh God.
Hold on. Have they separated it from nuclear weapon proliferation and nuclear energy, or is it still glommed together?
Suffice to say that the people who are opposed to nuclear energy always try to create an equivalence. They try to keep those two things combined. Now, I mean, if you ask me, right, I have a completely different viewpoint, which is to say, you know, I am very pro-civil applications of nuclear energy, including possibly, if it proves to be as useful as it, you know, was suggested once might be, possibly civil applications of nuclear explosives, because there are some. Partly for scientific research, actually. The Soviets did quite a bit of scientific research that way, including...
Project Daedalus. There you go.
Seismic soundings. But the other thing being that I have kind of, a different opinion about the whole nuclear weapons proliferation thing than most people. My opinion is... Right. I am opposed to warfare because it's horribly destructive, and I think the lesson of the 20th century, you look at the First and Second World Wars, is you don't need nuclear weapons to have a war on a scale that would collapse a civilization.
Sure.
Nuclear weapons just make it go
Attention
faster.
On radio listeners. Coming up
that,
at 0300 hours UTC is a Penmic with open mic. Anyone can stream.
Suck away 40% of your national income and things like that are okay as long as you don't have nuclear weapons. You know, we're still going to be in this cycle where we're burning up our resources, right, you know, blowing things up or making weapons and what have you. And, you know, I really think people need to look at the whole picture and say, wait, you know, yes, definitely strategic deterrence, you know, that which combines, you know, blackmail and genocide. That's really bad. I'm not totally sure that... You know, I'm not totally sure that. I guess I object to the proposition that nuclear weapons are the thing to be afraid of uniquely, because what it looks like to me, and you'll forgive me, this is one of my weird political, you know, sort of sociological theories, but you can think about it and see if that sounds reasonable at all to you, right, is that after the end of the Second World War, it was obvious to anybody that no large-scale war like that could ever happen again because we would be utterly ruined.
Sure.
And the thing was, the United States and the Soviet Union were both cultures that had, certainly from the time of the First World War onward, sort of embraced militarism, you know, the idea of the armed conflict and military force being an integral part of the way not only that you that you settle disputes between countries, but also internal politics, right? The internal politics and the internal economy very much geared towards this, you know, militaristic situation. So nobody was going to throw out all the generals. Nobody was going to throw out all the war profiteers and so on, right? They weren't going to stand for a total change in their social structure. They wanted to keep their prestige. They wanted to keep their economic and political influence. But at the same time, they knew they couldn't have another war. So what do? Well, right at the end of the Second World War comes this thing, the atom bomb. And it's terrifying because you can wipe out an entire city with one bombing raid instead of needing like the number of bombers that they sent against Tokyo or Dresden, right? Thousands and thousands of bombs every night for a week. You could do it with one bomb. And that's terrifying. You know,
yeah.
It's like Fred Hoyle in his book A Decade of Decision, which he must have written about the same time that he was writing the paper on nucleosynthesis, which is, you know, his great astrophysics paper, in which he showed how carbon is formed in stars. But Fred Hoyle pointed out, you look at the success rate of the British air defenses during the Second World War, and he says, you know, even if we were to be able to knock down 99% of incoming bombers, which is far better than we ever achieved. If every one of us loaded with an atom bomb, we would not have a London left over. And, you know, a rate of fire, you know, just Hiroshima-style bombs on London in the morning. You know, so that, you know, it's terrifying because it's very fast. But I think that point, it's a case of strategic deterrence is a way, in a sense, to perpetuate the existing political system, you know, political and economic system.
Gotcha.
And so the thing everybody has to be afraid of is radioactivity, because that's the one qualitative difference between being bombed by, you know, having the shit bombed out of you by firebombs and TNT and having the shit bombed out of you by an atom bomb is the radioactivity. And so I think that the fear of radioactivity really, as much as anything, it's a political outgrowth of the Cold War, because it was the one way that everybody could be convinced, oh no, well, we can't have a nuclear war. The U.S. and the Soviet Union can never go to war because that would definitely involve using nuclear weapons, and nuclear would be so horrible they'd render the entire planet uninhabitable. Well, they wouldn't. The plain fact is that they wouldn't. I have a friend who grew up in Los Alamos, and she says she's not afraid of the atom bomb. She's afraid of warfare. Sure, she doesn't want to be blown up, right? But she doesn't believe this whole thing about how, you know, one atom bomb would be catastrophe for the entire Earth. And the reason she doesn't believe that is she's been to the places where the three first atom bombs were exploded. She's been to Trinity Site in New Mexico. She went there on a family vacation, and she was standing out there, right?
Other parties in this conference.
She's standing out there on the site where the fireball touched the ground, which is the thing you don't want to have happen. With the place where the fireball touched the ground, and there's this little, you know, which is the base of the shot tower, and little bits of twisted steel sticking up, and there's a plaque. And she's standing there, and a horny toad runs over her foot. And she says, you know what? This is not by far the worst place I've been in New Mexico. There's plenty of places in New Mexico that are nastier than this. And so I don't see what the big deal is with these atom bombs. Clearly, they don't render the Earth uninhabitable. You know, and then she was in 2007 when the World Science Fiction Convention was in Japan.
Attention on radio listeners. Coming up at 0300 hours UTC is a Penmic with open mic. Anyone can stream.
And she and her husband went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And she says, yeah, okay, so they, you know, they've preserved the central portion, right, where the hypocenter was. They preserved as a park, but they've also rebuilt all around it. You know, if they'd rebuilt there, too, you would never have known that Hiroshima had the shit bombed out of it by an atom bomb in 1945 because, you know, it's a city. It looks pretty much the same as any other Japanese city, and the same with Nagasaki. It does not look like a place that was, you know, turned into a wasteland for 10,000 years. Because, you know, there's just no such thing. Now, admittedly, right, the hydrogen bombs, the big hydrogen bombs of the, the big hydrogen bombs of the 1960s, you know, the Castle Bravo, Ivy Mike-style bombs, which were set off at sea level because they were, you know, the thing was, like, Ivy Mike was a big thermos flask full of liquid deuterium. You know, it was built on the ground. It was a building, right, that they detonated. And, you know, and so it produced immense amounts of fallout in the atmosphere. But even so, the thing was that even with Castle Bravo, which was the detonation that was three times larger than anticipated because of an unexpected effect in nuclear physics, which also produced massive, massive amounts of fission products, because most of the energy in Castle Bravo came from fission, not fusion. The fusion provided neutrons, which then caused fast neutron fission in the depleted uranium that they'd expected would just be vaporized inertly. No, it underwent fission and produced immense amounts of fission products and immense amounts of energy. So like two-thirds of that bomb yield was fission, which was totally unexpected, produced immense amounts of fallout. But even still, you know, the thing you hear about is always the Fukuryu Maru, right? The Japanese fishing boat where the fallout rained down on it and there were people who died as a result of, you know, severe radiation. Well, the crew developed severe radiation burns. Well, the crewman who died, he died after being taken back to Tokyo for treatment. And the treatment involved, and this is the most insane medical treatment I've ever heard of, they were draining the blood from his body and re-injecting it intramuscularly. Now, I am pretty sure, I mean, don't quote me on that, because you would have to consult a medical expert. I am pretty sure that a healthy person would die if you did that.
Yeah, I think so. That sounds like an experiment.
It was a crazy thing to do.
Yes, I mean, I'm just thinking The Incredible Hulk in a way, but that was a different process for I was going to say Bill Bixby, but it's not Bill Bixby. That's the actor.
You Jack Kirby?
No, I'm just saying that, you know, maybe they thought,
Bruce,
we inject the blood. Yeah, Bruce Banner. If we inject the blood into his muscles, we'll make him super strong man.
Yeah, it's mysterious. But I guess the thing is, you know, A. Patters mentions, you know, the idea of people who, you know, worry about bombs falling to the nation of non-nation actors, terrorists, and so on. The thing is, right, that the book I would love everyone to read is a book called The Atomic Complex by Bertrand Goldschmidt, who was the head of the French. He was basically the French Seaborg. He'd been the head of the French Atomic Energy Agency for a while. He was, he was in the room when the first neutron multiplication experiment in uranium was conducted. He was in the room when Joliot Curie filed the patent application on the atomic bomb. This is the thing nobody knows, is that in a couple of weeks before the Second World War broke out, Frederick Joliot Curie, in the big laboratory in Paris, which was sponsored by the French government, filed patents on the nuclear chain reaction and the nuclear reactor and the atomic bomb. Patents which were never respected by anybody, of course. But anyway, Goldschmidt has some really interesting things to say about nuclear proliferation and that kind of thing from a non-U.S. perspective. And I think it's really worth reading. Thing is, there's a lot of literature on topics like this in French, which has not been translated into English. But this one book was translated into English by the the Nuclear Professional Society. The American Nuclear Society. Anyway, they thought it was worth reading, and so they had it translated professionally into English and published. It's a really good book, but it talks about nuclear nonproliferation and the way that, you know, to a great extent, it's a political
20
issue
seconds, Publius.
Manipulated by national governments. Anyway,
15
basically,
seconds.
Anyway. So that's about all I have to say about that.
Thank you for listening to Open Vape. Go watch Publius on Twitch TV, Publius Select, Publius, oh shoot, I screwed up. Search for Publius.